Good morning. It is good to be here at Theodore Parker Church for, I think it's my just second visit, and I, like you, am glad it's not snowing today so that I could be here and didn't get snowed out. Theodore Parker Church is one of about 50 member congregations of the Unitarian Universalist Urban Ministry. And there are a number of ways that Theodore Parker connects with the work of the UU Urban Ministry. I want to first begin with one of my dearest colleagues, Reverend Ann, used to work at the Urban Ministry before I did, and she is one of my most dear and beloved colleagues who supports me. We support one another in a small clergy group, and that is one way that we're connected. Each year, Susan Karen does tickets to safety in support of our Renewal House work, for which we are really grateful. And I want to thank you all for the ways that you give so generously to that, to support our work for domestic violence survivors. Claire Barker is a former delegate and now a volunteer for us. Posey Walton and David Harrington are two of the current delegates who support our work so ably. And today, I think at least David will be at our Ties That Bind concert, helping welcome visitors to the Urban Ministry. So there are many ways that you really connect with our work, and we're really grateful. I also want to say my colleague, Annie Stubbs, is here. And Annie is going to be in social hour and able to answer any other questions that you have for us. So I'm wondering this morning whether this has happened to you in the past couple of years. Has there been a day when you could no longer listen to the news? And so you turned off the radio or shut off the TV or folded up your newspaper, even removed the Facebook app from your smartphone. Last summer that happened to me. It was on the heels of news stories about immigrant families that were being torn apart at the border. It was on the heels of news about the rolling back of environmental protections and increasing threats to our Mother Earth. I couldn't bear my news loop. And so I turned off my car radio and I looked for another way to pass the time on my daily commute into Roxbury. I began listening for the first time to audiobooks. I chose first 1776, a Pulitzer Prize-winning history of the military battles of that year. It may sound dry, but I listened rapt to hear how the Roxbury campus, where the Urban Ministry stands, played a key role during the siege of Boston, how Patriot troops gathered on the green space where I walk daily, how General George Washington visited. The nitty-gritty details of that long-ago time was a lovely respite from the shoulder-tensing, heart-dropping news. Getting away from today by immersion in the long ago was just the medicine that I needed. Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, was the book that I listened to next. Jefferson lived in intense times, and he also helped shape them. Inspired by Enlightenment ideals, he advocated for independence from Britain, drafted the Declaration of Independence, became our nation's first Secretary of State, and then later a president. And this, I kept listening. Jefferson, born into a slave-holding, privileged Virginia family, identified slavery as sinful but remained immersed in it until he died for his own life's comfort. He used his power over an enslaved woman in his household, her name was Sally Hemings, who then bore him children who lived not as beloved offspring, but as his profit-making slaves too. I kept listening. Jefferson early on advocated for abolishing slavery, that part of our history many of us have heard, but Jefferson did not believe that white people and black people could in fact live freely together. The only path he saw to abolishing slavery was to send the slaves away. Expatriation. At the root of it was his fear, a deep fear shared by his slaveholding neighbors that enslaved African Americans, if freed, would rise up and seek revenge on their oppressors. "We have the wolf by the ear," Jefferson wrote, "and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is on one scale and self-preservation on the other." And I listened to the centuries-old story of how those who have shaped our country were shaped themselves by a reliance upon and a fear of African Americans. I listened about how the role of the free press was a source of fraught national disagreement, how Congress became polarized over the politics of the day, so much so that debates became brawls and even duels. I no longer was stepping away from today's news stories. I was looking more deeply into them and seeing also that I must. Ours is an optimistic faith, one that looks toward the future. We define our Unitarian Universalist faith in many ways as covenantal instead of creedal. We challenge the status quo instead of preserving it. And this, we believe in progress, we believe in tomorrow, and we work for it. There was a Unitarian minister who you may have heard of before. His name was the Reverend Theodore Parker, who, in a quote made famous by the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, said this. I suspect it's familiar. "Look at the facts of the world. You see a continual and progressive triumph of the good. I do not pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one. My eye reaches but a little ways. I cannot calculate the curve and complete the figure by the experience of sight, but I can divine it by conscience. And from what I see, I am sure that it bends towards justice." Especially now, our Unitarian Universalist faith calls us to lead the way forward and away from the bubbling cauldron of angry nationalism and fear that is dragging us back. We are in a bruising tug of war, our fingers raw and curled tightly around the rope as we pull, resisting, slipping into the muck of the past, instead pulling toward the greener grass of a future that is more inclusive, more just, more loving, more open, a future in which the whole human family, Black, Brown, Indigenous, GLBTQ, all the ways we were born, that all of us have a place at the table. In the midst of the turmoil, something new is being born, and something is dying. But to be midwife to something new, to help birth a step in our human evolution, means we must not just grab the rope and tighter and simply pull forward. We must also look back. We must understand our history in order to really move ahead. This call to examine history is at the heart of the healing and justice work of the UU Ministry in Roxbury. Founded 190 years ago, the Urban Ministry is one of our nation's oldest nonprofits, and for about 40 years of that history, we've been located on a deeply historic campus in Roxbury, the heart of Boston's historic African-American community. Our campus is located in John Elliott Square, in a neighborhood where the Puritans gathered in 1631, where Irish immigrants came later, and then Jewish immigrants, and then the African-American community. Our campus includes our flagship building, Boston's oldest surviving wood-frame church, called First Church in Roxbury. No longer home to a congregation, it was built in 1804, the fifth meeting house on this site. This was the starting point for William Dawes' Midnight Ride of 1775, a ride to parallel Paul Revere's to warn that the British were coming. Our neighbors in Roxbury will celebrate that event tomorrow morning at our campus. In this historic place, we do three basic things today. We serve survivors of domestic violence. We support the education of young people of color from Roxbury, Mattapan, and Dorchester. And we serve our Roxbury neighbors through the arts, history, and culture. Here, we interrogate the past, and we also look with hope to the future. We honor personal history. For nearly 40 years, we've operated the Renewal House Domestic Violence Shelter that you so generously support. Last year, out of that work, we launched a job readiness program for survivors. We begin by honoring a survivor's own resilience. This is the way the director of that program describes our work. Instead of erasing the trauma of history and assault, we encourage survivors to acknowledge their history and their strength in living through it. Survivors examine their own childhoods and ask, what was helpful? What hurt? What do I want to pass on to my children? That recollection is painful, but it can break the cycle of violence. Naming history can change the future. To move ahead, we look back. We honor community history. Our youth program supports young people who have a drive to live into their own potential and future in the midst of an unjust educational system that bestows abundance on suburban white children as it skimps on children in Boston. We seek to level the playing field. We provide tutoring and college prep and college visits. We also celebrate the community from which our bright and determined young people come. We nurture a sense of history and place, training youth to research the history of our campus and Roxbury, developing their skills as guides to lead historic walking tours. Our dear friends Jennifer Bottomley and Jennifer Buchwald took an inaugural tour last summer with one of our guides, who also was named Jennifer. Seriously. And Jennifer is a high school student in Roxbury. Do you remember Jennifer? Yeah. She's a bright light. She spent the whole summer learning about Marcus Garvey, after whom the elder housing across the street from the urban ministry was named. She learned about Malcolm X, who once lived in Roxbury, about his time in prison, his conversion to Islam, his second chance, his transformational leadership. Her growing knowledge of the places that she passes by each day and what they represent deepen her neighborhood pride. Sometimes, she told me, people have a negative idea about Roxbury. She now knows the deeper stories of strength and resilience there. And she said that each of us has a responsibility to do likewise about our own communities, to learn our history. If you're going to live somewhere, she said, you should know about it. By looking back, she propels herself forward, and who knows how far she'll go. And examining the history of race in America is foundational for our community engagement work. Dismantling racism is not about personal guilt. It's about education and understanding. In the book we heard from earlier, So You Want to Talk About Race, the African-American author Ijeoma Alau describes the chasm in historic understanding between white people and black people in responding to the Black Lives Matter movement. She writes, if we want to understand how experiences and sentiments between police and communities of different races could be so different, we must first understand the historical relationship between police forces and communities of color. Alau describes how police forces, especially those in the South, grew out of night patrols, whose primary charge was controlling Black and Native American people, and slave patrols whose primary charge was catching escaped slaves. Out of these grew our modern police forces. She writes, "Our early American police forces existed not only to combat crime, but also to return Black Americans to slavery and to control and intimidate free Black populations. Police were rightfully feared and loathed by Black Americans in the North and South. Our police force," she writes, "was not created to serve Black Americans. It was created to police Black Americans and serve white Americans." That history is not about individual police officers. Rather, it's about the system that they and we inherit consciously and unconsciously. History illuminates this moment in time. Police, the prison system, health and wealth and educational disparities, all these call for an examination with an historical lens. Brian Stevenson, founder and executive director of the Equal Justice Initiative, which combats racial bias in the criminal justice system, founded a museum that tells the story of lynchings in the South, and he described why. In the American South, we don't talk about slavery. We don't have monuments and memorials that confront the legacy of lynching. We haven't really confronted the difficulties of segregation. And because of that, he said, we are still burdened by that history. We are still burdened by that history. To move forward together, we must look back. But we don't need to look down south to learn about deeply rooted racism and violence. Kevin Peterson of the New Democracy and Coalition is calling for a hearing to rename Faneuil Hall. Who has heard about the effort to rename Faneuil Hall? Many, many hands going up. Peterson, who's African American, is a man of deep faith. He sees his work for racial justice as spiritual, religious, and transformational work, the work of justice and reconciliation across differences of race. I met with him over coffee, and he shared that he began researching the history of Faneuil Hall at the same moment that our country was reeling from the white supremacist march in Charlottesville, and people were beginning to topple over Confederate statues. He researched the history of Peter Faneuil, the Hall's namesake, who was a mogul in Boston. Faneuil wanted a place where men like him, businessmen, could gather for commerce, and he even offered to pay for it with the money he had earned from tobacco and rum and the slave trade. Records tell how Faneuil's ship, which he called the Jolly Bachelor, carried slaves from Sierra Leone who desperately tried to escape and were recaptured. The creation of a building called the Cradle of Liberty, with money earned from the sale of enslaved people, is a painful irony. It's an insult, Peterson says, to the civic dignity of Blacks and whites alike. Nearby Faneuil Hall was the building where slaves would continue to be sold long after. Peterson sees in this foundation of Boston's commerce a thread that wends through history into today. When the racial wealth gap means that the median net worth, I don't mean income, I mean the amount you have left after you've subtracted your assets, where the median net worth in Boston for white households is $247,000, and for black households it is $8. We don't know the names of the enslaved people who were brought from Sierra Leone, who sought their freedom only to be recaptured again. But we are now being asked to consider their story, to reckon with that past. We arrive this morning in tumultuous times, with so much unrest, so much anger, so much disorientation. We watch for something new trying to be born in the midst of it. Something new in which voices long hidden and silenced are raised up and finally heard, where we are all called to the table, when we have reckoned with the past and can be freed from what still haunts us. This is painful and unsettling work. We may be tempted to get lost in the anger of our times or to turn away. We may feel afraid. We may be tempted to vilify and simplify and simply react to the noise and the news. As people of faith, more is asked of us. We are asked to keep breathing in and out and holding to our center in the midst of the tumult. And we are asked to face the times in which we live and to face them with steadiness and with love, great, transforming, impossible love, and with knowledge, to learn the real history of our nation's founding and trajectory, to deepen our knowledge of the past so that we, as Unitarian Universalists, can be guides in leading our world forward. I invite you to do that work with us at the UU Urban Ministry, to come and volunteer with survivors in our job readiness program as they move their lives ahead. Even for one day, we need you. I invite you to come in and take a tour with the youth in our history program. Come in May for a community reading of African American authors. Come for a performance at 3:00 today honoring Martin Luther King. Come talk with us in social hour about all the ways to visit and tour and attend and connect and plug in. Come join us in this place where we keep learning from the past and lock arms and walk together into a brighter and more just future. Amen, and may it be so.